Rory was a, I only discovered this when you spoke to me before, that you were actually a lieutenant colonel in the police. Now, I remember from anybody here who did national service will remember a lieutenant colonel was a commandant. And you got, like, the corporal was God. And who knows what the lieutenant colonel was, maybe the king of the universe. And that's what you were.
Yeah, correct, Alec. I started on Madiba's team in 94 as a lieutenant colonel, and I finished as a lieutenant colonel because had I applied for any promotions beyond that to full colonel or brigadier, I would have had to move off the operational teams, and I didn't want to do that. So, yeah, I finished up there in 99.
Now, you mentioned Madiba, Nelson Mandela. Do you know why Nelson is such a popular name amongst people in Africa? Does anybody know? I only discovered this the other day.
Well, it's either because of him or because of Admiral Lord Nelson. One eye, one arm, one...
You're getting closer.
But
why would it be after Admiral Lord Nelson? Why is Nelson such a popular name in the African continent? Because of Horatio Nelson. Not at all. Nothing to do with the French. He was the man who was chasing down all the slave ships. As a consequence, what the Royal Navy did was they would stop, because in Britain, they abolished slavery long before most parts of the world.
Thanks, and actually, William Wilberforce.
Not Wilberforce and others. But not just did they abolish it, but they actually hunted down slavers. And the leader of those squadrons was Horatio Nelson. And as a consequence of that, people, especially in West Africa, but other parts of the continent as well, adopted the name Nelson in respect for the stuff that he did. And Yaz Ahmadiba comes down from those days. So it's interesting. There's that. And that's why, actually, I said to Rob, I'm sure you picked it up, when he started talking about, well, the electrification of Soweto started in 1994, it was bunk. We mustn't do this, guys. Go and double-check, triple-check history. History is written by the victors, of course, but in a case like this, when you talk about slavery, you know, people are real cross with the Brits because of slavery, but actually, there were lots of other people who were still enslaving less than 100 years ago. And so maybe the Brits can take a pat on the back, which is then reflected through Lord Nelson. But you know, anyway, it was just an interesting point.
Sorry, if I can interrupt you there, Alec, do you know why Madiba's name was Nelson, though?
I'm sure it was a family name, wasn't it?
No, it was a teacher in your... Well, you're claiming to come from somewhere in Northern Natal now, but a teacher in the Eastern Cape.
Jeanette's the Eastern.
Jeanette, okay.
So she was on Dirk's forefathers, was on the first ship that came out in 1820.
Yeah. Okay, so all of Madiba's schooling was at institutions established by Methodist missionaries in the Eastern Cape, from prep school to Fort Hare University. But one of his primary school teachers couldn't say the name Kgolihlahla, and so she gave him the name Nelson. The English name Nelson, yeah, primary school teacher.
He was not christened Nelson.
Not at all, no.
How interesting is that? Sure. So, how did you meet in the first place? Why would he, here, this freedom fighter, have taken a lieutenant colonel from the South African police as his bodyguard?
Very good question, and one that I'm often asked. And folks, it was absolutely nothing to do with me. I wasn't carefully selected or hand-picked or any of those cliches. I was merely in the right place at the right time, Alec. What I mean by that is I was the police commander of the VIP protection and bomb disposal unit in Joburg in 1990 when de Klerk released him. So I all of a sudden inherited a president who had both a home and an office in the town that I was head of VIP protection in. What that meant was, and this only really came to pass in 94, between 90, his release, and 94, becoming president, I had nothing to do with him. When my friend, where's Neil? Where's Neil de Beer? There he is. When Neil was protecting
him. Hey, Neil, yeah, there we go. Let's give him a hand.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So when Neil and his colleagues were protecting the president, I had nothing to do with him. But in 1994, when he became president, he chose not to live in the official residence in Pretoria, which is called Mahlambandlovu, which is the, correct me guys, it's either the Shangaan or the Pedi name for a new dawn, Mahlambandlovu. He named the official residence in Pretoria that name, but he didn't live there. He chose to live in Houghton with his four grandsons. The youngest two were literally, I mean, Andile was in nappies. Mbuso was a little toddler. Ndaba was in high school at Sacred Heart College. And Mandla was at varsity at Wits. And who would deny him that? He had been denied seeing his two daughters grow up, Zenani and Zinzi, because he was in jail. So when he said, I want to live with my grandsons, fine. So our job was to drive him the 60 Ks every day from Houghton to the Union Buildings. And so your question was, how did I get to meet him? I was involved with the protection of the 184 VIPs that came to attend his inauguration. And believe me, it was a huge thing. You can imagine. People who would never have crossed the border, never mind darkened the door of any establishment in South Africa. People of the ilk of Yasser Arafat, Muammar Gaddafi, Fidel Castro, never mind Mugabe and all the other guys to the north, were invited to the ceremony. And, you know, we were trained as cops that those guys had horns on their heads. They were devils, you know. And that unit that I commanded, remember there was no five-star hotel in Pretoria in 94. All the five-star hotels, Carlton, the Sandton Sun, the old Joburg Sun, they were all in Johannesburg. So we had 184 VIP motorcades that we had to move from Joburg to Pretoria to arrive in reverse order of their international precedence. Do you guys know that there's a pecking order for heads of state? Guess who's at the top of the pecking order? Those who have been in power the longest. Who are they? All those oaks I just mentioned. All the dictators are 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. So you try going to a dictator and telling him, sir, we need to leave now. Good luck with that. But we did, and we got those 184 motorcades going up. But I also received a telex. Yes, these youngsters are going to, what is a telex? You guys don't even know what a fax is. Never mind a telex. I got this telex saying that the newly elected president of the Republic of South Africa will fly from the Union Buildings to Ellis Park shortly after swearing the oath of office before the Chief Justice and attend a soccer match. Who does that? Great question. But Madiba did it and landed on the roof of the Technicon, drove around the corner and up the vehicle ramp and over a wooden floor like this, except it was parquet, I can tell you that. It was called the Yanni LaRue Salle, and it was right behind the president's suite at Ellis Park. And the two teams are lined up on the field, because it's a soccer match. And let me just pause there. Somebody very smart, and I don't say that facetiously at all, Alec, somebody very smart on the election committee decided if we put 60,000 soccer fans, all black, into Ellis Park, televise the proceedings from the Union Buildings on the big screens, well, then that is 60,000 fewer people moving on that freeway where we've got to move 184 VIP motorcades. Brilliant. And probably more importantly, 60,000 fewer people trying to cram onto the lawns of the Union Buildings where there was this huge party going on as black South Africans celebrated the dawn of freedom and democracy. And the partying, so I'm told, was also going on in the stands of Ellis Park. So here I arrive as the VIP unit commander and do what we would have done had FWB been going to rugby there. So we put the sniffer dogs, like you saw this morning, except they were flipping late and we all had to stand in the rain, put the sniffer dogs through the venue, control the entrances and exits and wait for that chopper to land and wait for the motorcade to drive him around the corner. All ANC. There was none of us white cops yet involved in Madiba's protection because it was day one. 10th of May, 94. He'd been president for half an hour. And he doesn't go into the doors of the president's suite because I told you the teams are waiting on the field. He goes straight to the lift, down to the dressing room level, and walks out onto the pitch. And now that party that's going on in the stands has reached new heights. And I'm asking myself, listen, man, have we done enough? Have we got enough assets and resources here? I've never worked with this man who's now the president, who's got a home and an office in my town. And I've never worked with an all-black soccer crowd. So I'm a little bit nervous. And he shakes hands with the two teams. By the way, the score's 0-0, and I'll tell you why that's important. He walks back up the tunnel, comes out the lift, apologizes. Gentlemen, excuse me, I've got to get to Pretoria. I've got 184 of the world's big shot VIPs waiting for me to host them for lunch. And they say, of course, sir, we're just glad you came. Gets in the car. I take a step back and literally and figuratively breathe a sigh of relief because we got him onto and off the field safely. And nothing happens. The motorcade doesn't move. And we see him trying to open the door. But he's in his late 70s, and it's a 3.8-ton armored BMW. So you don't just flick an elbow. So the team leader, Ayn Seagar, later became my colleague, calls the bodyguard in the car and says, hey, why does he want to get out? That guy says, I don't know. He hasn't said anything to me. Team leader opens the door. Dada, why do you want to get out? Old man says nothing to him. He gets out the way. Madiba walks around the bonnet of this BMW and starts heading for the back of this Yanni LaRue salle where the vehicle ramp is, where you should be driving out to go to the helipad. And guys, the only person standing at the back of this room is an old school apartheid era police colonel in his blue uniform, stars and full colonel, neo-commandant, full colonel, scrambled eggs on his cap. And his eyes are getting bigger and bigger and bigger because the old man is heading directly towards him and he's got no idea why. And neither have we, Alec. And we're tagging along in his wake. And the president stops in front of him, friends, puts out his hand and says, Colonel, I just want to tell you that today you have become our police too. He said, I'm now the president of this country. But I want you to know that from today forward, there's no more you and us. You are our police. And guys, this old warrior had the lines on his face to show that he'd pretty much seen and done it all in a long career. And he started to cry. And the tears ran down those lines on his face. And they were dripping like this onto that polished parquet wooden floor. And the old man just patted him on the shoulder and said, it's okay, Colonel. I just wanted to tell you that today. Turned on his heel, went back to the BMW and said, let's go to the chopper. Now, Alec, there's two things here that I hope you're getting. One, that colonel represented the system that pursued Mandela, arrested him, tried him, convicted him, and sent him to prison for life, narrowly avoiding the death penalty. Because the prosecution applied for the death penalty. And yet on the day, the very day, he's got all the power. He has just become the president. He takes the trouble to get out of that car. And here's the second thing it said to me. 184 of the world's big shots can just wait 2 minutes. Because that colonel needs to hear this from me today. And so if you ask me, and I'm not a politician, if you ask me, what was Madiba's agenda? I'm telling you that it was build one South Africa across those lines and divisions that so radically divided us as society. And he started with nation building on the day he became president, or half an hour after he swore the oath before the Chief Justice. And if you'd punched me in the nose, Alec, I would have been less surprised. Because I did not believe the stuff he said 4 years ago when he came out of prison, down the road in what was the Victor Verster prison. He went to the Grand Parade in Cape Town and he made his first speech as a free man. And the whole world's media were literally hanging off every word because nobody knew what he was going to say. We didn't even know what he looked like. You would remember, you were in the media then, Alec. It was a criminal offense to publish a photograph of or quote anything that a political prisoner said. So we didn't know what he looked like. We knew what he looked like when he went into jail in 64, but this is now 1990. And so what does he say? He says, amongst many other things, he quotes from the Freedom Charter, and he says, South Africa is for all her people, both black and white. And this cynical cop, sitting in his office in John Forster Square, yes, folks, in the notorious security branch of John Forster Square, that's where I worked. I was recruited because I'm English-speaking, and we needed to spy on a couple of you blooming radicals at Wits University. And you at Rhodes. Anyway,
I've got to ask you, did you guys listen in on the phone?
And Rosa said,
hey, man, I used to get these. And I think, what? What is? Just the security branch again. And it was a continuous, it seriously was.
No, you could hear it.
Yeah, you could hear these. Because
the technology was very amateur.
Yeah, then they went very good.
And I'm going to tell you a story about that. Let me just finish this and I'll be very quick. So, where was I?
You were telling the story about how you first met Madiba and why you joined John Forster.
Yeah, John Forster.
You were listening better than me.
No, but I was going somewhere. I'd moved on, man. The speech. So he says, South Africa is for all the people. I don't believe it. That's 1990. The 11th of February was released and he went straight to the Grand Parade. Now I hear this exchange with my colleague. And as you know, my rank was only one rank lower than that colonel. And if you threw a bucket of cold water or smacked me in the head, I would have been less surprised because I didn't believe what he said when he went to the Grand Parade. I was trained as a cop. Then I was trained as a security branch cop. And I said, yeah, whatever, man. Of course you're going to say that. That's the party line. Now I hear this private exchange. Guys, it was not a media moment. There were no media there. There were maybe 15 of us, a handful of all cops and security guys. And he's already elected. He doesn't need to be electioneering now. And you think of any cliche, it took the wind out of my sails. It knocked my feet from under me, whatever. But I started to question all of this upbringing. And I thought, Rory, have you not been wrong? So I don't know whether Helen Ziller is here tonight. She said she was going to be here because she dodged me in the Berg.
She had to go home.
Oh, shame. Okay. But, you know, maybe I'm a bit doff and I'm a bit slow. But she was an anti-apartheid activist, as you said. So she saw the light long before I did. I only realized that day when I heard him tell my colleague that you are our police. And I thought, hell, man, maybe I must give this old man a chance. Maybe I've been wrong. And so I did, and I started to watch him, and because of the privileged position that I had, head of VIP protection, he's got a home and an office there, so I spent 3/4 of my day doing what we call advanced security, and you all saw it this morning. That was advanced security. I won't comment on how effective it was, but it was advanced security. That's what I did. And it helped that I was head of both bomb disposal and VIP protection. So I killed 2 birds with 1 stone, and I used to do that for him. And then, because there was no presidential protection unit yet, Alec, we hadn't yet integrated the ANC, APLA, and what we euphemistically called the non-statutory forces into the civil service forces, the police and the military and the medical services. That was all still happening. Until one day, and this is where your question comes in about the bug telephones, until one day I got a call, it was January of 96. So between 10th of May 94, Madiba's day one, and January of 96, I did the advanced security when he was in Joburg, which was a lot of the time. Mondays was always ANC business day, so he was down at Luthuli House, formerly known as Shell House. 96, I get a call. It's the police colonel who trained me back in 1987 in VIP protection, Lawrence Jacobs. By the way, there's a CakeNet documentary coming out on Lawrence, I think in August or September, that I contributed to. He phones me, he says, Rory, Etienne van Eck, who was the first white team leader, has is going to study in Canada. He's leaving the country. You're the right rank. You know the president. He knows you. You know the teams and they know you. Would you consider applying for that position, team leader? I said, give me 24 hours. I need to consult the government at home. Your sister, Fiona. So I discussed it with my wife and we instantly agreed it would be great and the best decision I ever made, she and I. And I said yes. So now I get transferred to Pretoria, to the Presidential Protection Unit that has now been evolved. I get there, Jason Chabalala. This is how it worked. We had two teams in Gauteng, in Pretoria. We had two teams here because of Parliament. So I was the team leader of the one team, and I had an MK2IC. Salbi Masekane is no longer here with us. Jason Chabalala, MK, was the head of the other team, and he had a white 2IC, Des van Rooyen. So Jason says, Rory, why don't you just go down to the union buildings, go and introduce yourself to the staff there and get the program for next week? I said, sure, get in my car, go there. Walk in, ask for the president's PA. I walk into the office and there's this tall, regal, Xhosa lady called Miriam Kadana. She's also no longer with us. She was part of, her husband ran the choir at the St. George's Cathedral called Imilanji Konto. Imilanji Kanto, that sang the national anthem at the Rugby World Cup final in 95. Those ones with those dresses on with the flag, that's them. Alec, Mary in her previous life, was the secretary to the general secretary of the South African Council of Churches. When I was recruited into the special branch, very green, very wet behind the ears, very naive, I was put on the churches section. I was told by my commander, go to the technical unit in John Forster, go and get the tapes of the phones we've bugged in Khotso House and listen to them and write down anything subversive. That was my brief. What do I know? 70% of the conversations I can't understand because they were in either Zulu or Sotho, and I didn't speak either of those at the time. So I wrote down the 30% that I thought was subversive because it was in English. Guess who Madiba's PA is when I walk into that office? Mary Mkadana. And I go cold. I look at this. I think, no, man. I said to her, Sis Mary, before we start here, I need to tell you something. I said, you worked for Dr. Wolfram Kistner at Khotso House, didn't you? She said, yes. I said, I was the security branch cop who bugged your phone. And there's this pregnant silence like now. And I think, okay, I'm either getting fired or this might just work out. And she threw back her head and roared with laughter and said to me, in what other country can this conversation happen than here?
And your first proper engagement with Madiba in person, your first interaction with him?
He had obviously been briefed by Jason and the other members of the team that there was this new guy coming to replace Etienne. So he knew who I was. I mean, he was no fool. And he was militarily trained, remember? So there was never an occasion where, although there probably was an introduction, but it wasn't a big deal. No big deal was made of it. I think maybe Jason or somebody or even my commander, Lawrence Jacobs, came on the first day and introduced me. But I can't recall, Alec. I just remember I've got a job to do. That's why I'm here. Keep your head down, get your bum up and do your job. And I'm proud to say, and Neil mentioned it to me, that I'm very proud to say that he and I developed a very good relationship. But I won't say it was different to any of the other relationships, because Alec, we were a team. We really were a team. I led a great team of men and women, and I must acknowledge the women I had serving under me. They were brilliant. You know, bodyguards are males mostly, and they got egos. So when some cute blonde comes and flutters her eyes there and says, oh, please, can you get the president to sign my book, my copy of Long Walk to Freedom? We're probably going to make a plan. Try that with a female bodyguard. One word. No. Sit. Done. The matter's off the table. So I learned from our black colleagues on the teams that how they greeted him was they called him Tata, which is short for Tata Umkulu, grandfather, because he was a whole generation older than our parents. So we white cops learned to do the same thing. And who mentioned it? Neil mentioned it, I think. That 95 World Cup, guys, go and watch that footage. He's absolutely 100% correct. White South Africans did not know in 1995 that if Madiba walked into a crowd like this and it was all black and the people didn't know him, they would automatically call him Madiba. We didn't know that as whites. So this crowd of mainly Afrikaners are chanting his name as he walks onto that field wearing Francois Pinault's number 6 shirt. And what they are chanting is, Nelson, Nelson, Nelson. And I was actually protecting the All Blacks that day. And Andrew Mertens, the All Blacks fly off, wanted to go and check the pitch conditions. So he says to me, I want to check the pitch conditions. I said, I'll come with you, Mertz. And we walk out of that tunnel as the Boeing flies over the first time. And I just hear this explosion of sound. I look up and it says, good luck, Bokke, on the wings. And, you know, we go back up the tunnel. I come back out for the anthems with the rest of the team, and he walks out there, and that's what they chant. Now, this former security branch cop, who thought that that guy was a terrorist, as did most of that crowd, I think, I was literally pinching myself. What am I hearing? Yeah, are a bunch of burkis, whites, 99.8% of them chanting his name, just because he put that number 6 shirt on. So, Neil, you're 100% correct. And he did. He had to go to the whatever the forerunner was. I think it was the National Sports Congress, the NSC, who was taking a vote to do away with the Springbok emblem. And he went there and he convinced them. And I think they won that vote by 12 votes. Talking about Chris Pappas in 42. 12 votes to keep the emblem. Because Madiba, so he told us later, got to understand the mind and the mentality of the Afrikaner by talking to his jailers on the island. Think of the nous, guys. Think of the political nous, the insight, the foresight that takes. He thinks, I'm sitting in prison for my beliefs. One day I'm going to have to negotiate with these boere. I better learn how they think. So he starts talking to them. And he told us a funny thing one day. He said, you know, this thing of if you want something done, go to the top. He says, yeah, that can work, but it doesn't work all the time. He said, when we were on the island, our privileges, if you want to call them that, were determined by our race. So a black prisoner had to wear short pants, short sleeve shirt, no shoes. He got sandals. A colored or an Indian prisoner, I forget which, what the pecking order was, Durham got long pants, a short sleeve shirt, shoes, no socks. A white prisoner, long pants, long sleeve shirt, shoes, and socks. And the number of blankets you were entitled to was determined by your race. That's how ridiculous that system of apartheid was. So now it's cold. I mean, Robben Island sits in the Southern Ocean. It's not that far from the Drake Passage, which is, you know, the other side of that is Antarctica. So it gets blooming cold there in winter. Now he wants another blanket. So if you want to change your privileges, you've got to write a letter in triplicate, viervoud, to the Commissioner of Prisons. That's the guy at the top. Dear sir, we hereby request an additional blanket for the winter months. 2 weeks later, you get a one-line reply, probably from a clerk, that just says, application denied. Klagelach. So Madiba said, you don't do that. You wait for one of the prison wardens to come on duty, who you know is actually a decent bloke. When he walks past your cell, you politely say, excuse me, sir, it's cold. May I have another blanket, please? And the guy will say, just give me a minute. Go to the cupboard, unlock it, get another blanket and give it to you. And that's why when Madiba was inaugurated on that day that I'm talking about, the 10th of May, 1994, he invited three of his prison wardens to his inauguration. Because they had treated him with some form of human decency. And he didn't forget it. Now, Alec, you can't teach that or coach that or train that. That common touch, He had it in spades, in bucket loads, and we saw it every day.
How did he introduce himself to people when he greeted people?
He was classic. He would, and I saw this so many times, and especially with ladies. Justice Johan Krichler, who was the head of the IEC at the first, there was a black tie function at the Saint and Sun, I think to celebrate the success of the election or whatever. And, you know, we always had a little holding room. I don't know where Paul Mashatile was, by the way, before he came into the tent.
He was in a holding room.
Okay. Yep. So we always have a holding room in case he needs.
So with a microwave, by the way, so that his tea could be warmed up or the milk could be warmed up for his tea.
Okay, we're not talking about him. So there was a holding room where if he wanted a one-on-one with maybe the host or a minister or somebody else there, he could do that. And also the MC would want to get the 600-odd guests, as it was that night at the Saint and Sun, settled and in there. And then they'll send word, okay, so we're ready. And then the MC will announce, ladies and gentlemen, please be upstanding the President of the Republic, President Nelson Mandela. And everybody applauds and he walks in. The first thing I'll say about that, and you've seen the staff here, Madiba would not leave that holding room where there were cocktails and canapes until he had thanked all of the waiters. That's the first thing. Lesson there, guys. The second thing I'll say is that Johan Krichler brought his daughter, 22, 23-year-old young lady at Wits studying, to introduce her to the president. And that was the first time I saw it, and I saw it countless times after that. And as she put out her hand to greet him, because he had impeccable manners, and I think he was a bit of a flirt. He loved female company. And he put out his hand to greet her, and suddenly it dawned on her who she was standing in front of. And then they just dissolve into tears, and they stand there gibbering, blubbering wrecks, and they can't get a word out. But he had this disarming way if he met, and I saw him do this in the airport. Imagine walking into the arrivals terminal at O.R. Tambo. Bedlam ensues. And he had an amazing ability. He would scan the room like this and he would pick out the leaders there. Just by your body language, your deportment, he could see. And he would walk up to you and he'd put out his hand. He would say, you may recognize me, but what is your name? That's how he would introduce himself to people. You know? Simple as that. Yeah.
Extraordinary. Extraordinary. Rory, let's move on to the rugby side now. What those of you who don't follow rugby won't know is that Rory's son is the captain of the Glasgow Warriors, who came to Loftus-Versfeld and beat the Bulls.
Where are the Bulls supporters? Put your hands up. Ja, jelle donors, ne?
In the final of the big URC competition last year. So his son's story and Rory's involvement there is really fascinating and I think worth going back, because a lot of people will think, well, you're born an athlete, then you're going to play for South Africa under 20, which that would be the normal progression, and then you're going to play for South Africa and you're going to be a Springbok, especially if he's your son. But that isn't the way it turned out.
No, it's not. And since I've recognized Helen in her absence and Neil at the back, I just saw Judith Foot here. So her late husband, Brandon Foot, was for many, many years involved in the leadership of the Northern Titans cricket. So obviously he was a Bulls supporter as well, but he was a wonderful man. And he was chairman or president of Supersport, Judith? Yeah. President, yeah. Just a wonderful guy. Very involved in Supersport and the president of the cricket union there. But I want to acknowledge the Bulls supporters. You know, if you looked on Superbrew, 94% of the predictions on Superbrew said the Bulls would win. Rightly so. They went and beat Leinster and they bullied Leinster. And Glasgow came there having already beaten Munster in the semi-final in Limerick in Ireland, only got into South Africa on the Tuesday and Wednesday as the flights came in and beat the Bulls at Loftus. And those Bulls supporters, there's obviously going to be one or two idiots who are going to whinge. The majority of the Bulls supporters just said, fair play, Glasgow. You guys were better than us today. And that's rugby.
Tell us how they achieved it, though. Where did it all? Because you got the inside track there. Your son is the captain.
And
there's a South African.
If you do their security.
if you do their security.
When they come here,
And the coach is a South African. Now, again, many people wouldn't know that. Tell us about it.
That's the reason. Franco Smith is the reason. He is just a refined version of Rassie. He doesn't talk like Rassie, but he's equally a rugby genius. And he's very, very humble, but very, very thorough. Let me tell you a bit about Franco Smith. So first of all, he's a Springbok. Played, I think, 6 or 7 test matches in the Rassie Erasmus, Bobby Skinstad era, around there. Coached, after his playing days, he coached Shimla's, University of the Free State. He coached the Free State Cheetahs. And then he, almost in the old days, in the apartheid years, he just wanted to spread his wings. Now think of that, a boykie from Bloemfontein thought, I want to go and see some of the world. And he went to Italy to play rugby when rugby was in its infancy there. And then he stayed there. So he says, now when he speaks to these Glasgow Warriors boys, he says, I'm speaking my third language. My own language is Afrikaans, but my second language is Italian. And then I speak English. He becomes the coach, and then he becomes director of rugby for the Italian Rugby Federation. And he discovers that there's only 2 professional franchises in Italy, Zebre Parma and Benetton, which was then called Treviso. And there was no player pathway, no pipeline. How do we develop talent? So he put those structures in place. And then he became head coach of Italy. And to be fair, he didn't have a great record as head coach of Italy, but that's because of the limit. It's a bit like Wales today. What do you do when you just don't have the player depth and talent? But the Italy you see now, who's going to play England on Saturday, that is a very, very different Italy, because those are the players that Franco Smith nurtured when he was director of rugby and he put the pathways in place. Now he gets this. By the way, he told me he's never applied for a job. He's always been asked to apply for a job. He was asked to throw his hat in the ring for Glasgow. They had a very successful Kiwi coach who took them to the Pro 14 final, which they blooming well lost in Dublin, in Glasgow, to Leinster. Can't stand Leinster. And he goes to Glasgow. And Kyle tells me, he says, yes, Dad, I'm a bit nervous about this because Franco mustn't come here with that Burki mentality of ons gaan hulle donor and all that, because these Glaswegians won't relate to that. But Franco didn't. One of the first things he did was he came there on a morning, 7:30 in the morning, those clock in there at Scotstoun. He had a whole bunch of little plastic glasses, but they're plastic, with whiskey. He threw all of them a wee dram. And he said, guys, I'm making a deal with you today. If you trust me, we are going to drink whiskey and celebrate the winning of a trophy. That day in June last year, when they beat the Bulls at Loftus, out came the whiskey and the cigars, and they celebrated. So Franco Smith is right up there. You know, Alec, when they... So as I told you, those players came in on the Tuesday and Wednesday of that week, and I had changed all my flights. I was working on the Cricket World Cup in the USA, and I was going to stay on in the US and see friends and do a bit of stuff. And they went and beat Munster. I said, I can't not be there. So I changed my flight. So I fly in from Dubai on Emirates with about 8 of the last players coming in. They go to the hotel, they change. I go home, I shower, I change. I go straight to the training session at St. Stivian's school, where Mel and Bob's kids went. And it's now the Wednesday. They're playing the final on Saturday against the Bulls. They've just got the squad together for the first time, having come in on a number of different flights, as I said. And I watch this training session. There is total calm. There is laser-like focus and accuracy. Every pass, the zip on the ball from the halfbacks. And I looked at this and I thought, the Bulls are in trouble on Saturday. Vrachtig.
It was And the rest is history.
And the rest is history.
Yeah. I want to talk to you about your business, but before we talk about your business life, tell us a little bit more about Kyle. How did he end up playing for Scotland, not for South Africa?
No, sure. I don't want to sound as if I'm boasting about my son, as proud.
You're allowed to.
As proud of him as we are. But the reason is I married well. So that's my wife's sister there. So I married a girl born in Glasgow. She was the second born of four girls. That's the baby there, the fourth one. And the elder two were born in Glasgow, and the younger two were born here. And they grew up in Krugersdorp, went to Krugersdorp High. And I met her at the church that I and she attended in Krugersdorp. And I was a cop, a young cop in my first year. In 1982, I'd done a year of police training, and that's where I met Jill. So she was born in Glasgow, but she sounds like you and me. She has no Scottish accent, although her parents never lost their accents. Her father was broader Glaswegian than either of his brothers who still lived in Glasgow, and he'd been here for, you know, any number of years. And so my wife and our three boys have all got dual nationality. Kyle got a good matric, and he had a number of varsities open to him, but he told us, "Mom, Dad, I want to go to Stellenbosch." We said, "Okay, that's fine. What are you going to study there? It doesn't matter. I want to play rugby." And that's how he still is. You've never seen a kid more single-minded in anything than that boy was about playing rugby. Now, he went to Trinity House in Joburg. Put your hand up if you've ever heard of Trinity House. Oh, surprisingly, there's quite a few. So Trinity House is a very new private school. It started around about democracy, when three former inspectors of education took their pensions, put it into a school and said, education is going to be a big thing in the new South Africa. And they started this little school, no rugby legacy to speak of. He comes out of that environment, goes to Stellenbosch. Now imagine going to your first under 20 practice at Marties. And you've got all these Craven Week players there. Paul Roos Gymnasium and Paul Boys High and Paul Gym and Affies. Daar staan hulle, die hele lot. And this little Engelsman comes there and he says, I'm going to make this team. He makes the team. He makes the Varsity Cup team the next year. He makes Marty's first team and graduates with a BSc in Human Life Sciences and a postgrad in teaching. Because he didn't want to do anything in sciences, because he said, Dad, I can't sit behind a computer and do research. His mother says, why don't you study teaching? No, Mom, there's no money in teaching. I said, hey, don't worry about the money. That'll come. What about the fact that teaching teaches you procedure and method, and there's a process to it, a process that makes sense to it. There's a word for that I can't grab. And Harvey's Fourie, who was the coach then of Marty's, who's now coaching the Cheetahs, came to him and said, Kyle, I need one more season out of you. Now I've got to find another postgrad to pay for, although by then he had a 70%, 75% bursary from Marty's. So we find him a postgrad, and he finishes his second, he gets his second runners-up medal. So he played in two finals, and they never won one of them. And Varsity Cup finishes in May, and Harvey's Fourie calls him and another English-speaking kid who was a loose forward, Dylan Pretorius, I think. He says, guys, I've just received a phone call from the coach at Griquas in Kimberley. They need a 13 who can cover wing, and they need an eighth man who can cover seven. Are you guys interested? There's a professional contract going. So he phones my wife and I. We say, take it. So he goes to Griquas, small province with the previous, you know, serious Curry Cup history. The first winners of the Curry Cup, don't forget, are Griquas. And the second season, he captains them.
Just for those who don't know, where is Griquas?
Kimberley.
It's
in the middle of nowhere. Now it's properly in the middle of nowhere. When De Beers, you know, did everything around sport in Kimberley, it was really wonderful. And it's just gone a little bit backwards because that big hole is closed and the diamonds no longer get mined there. But Gregor Townsend, the current Scotland coach, was then the Glasgow Warriors coach, and he came to spy on the Cheetahs in Bloemfontein because the Cheetahs were playing in what was then called the Pro 14. And the next week they were playing Glasgow. Glasgow were coming out. So Gregor comes the week before to check how the Cheetahs play in Bloom. And he's having a beer with a SuperSport commentator, Judith. And the commentator says to him, "Hey, Gregor, do you know that down the road here in Kimberley, there's a lighty who's Scottish qualified through his mother?" And that's how it happened. The next thing, the phone rang, and the voice said, "I'm so-and-so from the Scottish Rugby Union. I'm the director of rugby. Would you be prepared to come and play a trial for Scotland Sevens? If we can figure it out with Griquas," it was pre-season. So they did, and he went across, went to Vancouver, went to Vegas, went to Hong Kong, and played a couple of games for Sevens for Scotland Sevens. And I was in Hong Kong, and I was watching these Scottish Sevens, and they were bang average. I said to him afterwards, "Boyki, there's no future in Scotland Sevens." I said, "You need to stick to 15s. He says, "I know, Dad. I figured it out myself." And right then Glasgow had a Stuart Hogg was still playing for them. And they had a whole bunch of injuries in the back three, the wings and fullback. And they needed somebody. And they said to Carl, "Go to Glasgow Warriors." Because in Scotland, all professional rugby players, like in New Zealand, are centrally contracted. So they can tell you, you're playing for Glasgow, you're playing for Scotland, you're playing Sevens, the women's team, whatever, they're all centrally contracted. So they said, "Go to Glasgow." And he never looked back. And he achieved, those goals. And he doesn't know what he wants to do after rugby. But what he does know is he wants to come back here. I mean, I don't blame him. That weather flapping out. Glasgow. No. Anyway, right.
But Rory, you were here on Tuesday night with Yvonne Milan.
Oh, what a
When she was telling the story of Sailor Milan, there were so many little curves in the road. And this reminds me of what you've just said with Kyle. If he hadn't gone to Trinity, he might have been picked up by someone else. If he hadn't gone to Marty's and really persevered, and then if the Greek was...
Yeah.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? But how life has it's almost preordained in a way.
Yes, it is. It's almost like there's a higher hand, but you only see that when you look back. But the point is, Alec, that what was the point?
Yeah, when you look back, it's very, very good point. Everything makes sense in hindsight.
Well, 2020. Yeah.
Everything makes sense. Brad Barrett is back as well. I mean,
Well, he played for England.
Exactly, but he's back in South Africa.
Is he really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I spoke to him not long ago. He's in Cape Town now. So it seems to be go there, go and play, become heroes for the British teams, but your heart doesn't ever leave South Africa.
Yeah, so look, maybe the last thing I'll say, and then we can move on, is that Kyle isn't like the other South Africans playing for Scotland. So he, Doan van der Merwe, Pierre Schoeman, VP Nel, Josh Strauss back in the day, they qualified for Scotland by dint of playing there for 5 years. So then you qualify on residency. They don't become citizens. Kyle is a citizen. He's actually half Scottish because his mother was born there and his grandparents were born there. The fact that he grew up in Joburg and played, look, and the Stormers and the Lions made a lot of promises when he was at Griquas, but nothing ever came through. So he grabbed that opportunity, and I say good luck to him, and he's made it work.
So he's played for Scotland, scored a lot of tries, beat England. He didn't play the latest one against England, but he probably beat them every time they... And that just explain the Calcutta Cup to us and why that's so important.
What a pleasure. So the Calcutta Cup is the oldest rugby trophy in the world, international rugby trophy in the world. And it comes from the days of the Raj when the British Empire occupied India. There was a garrison of soldiers in Calcutta. And one day they decided, well, let's play a rugby match. So they got the Scottish Oaks to play the Poms. And I think they had four or five of those fixtures. And then... the British Empire was starting to wane. There were a lot of other sports and attractions to attract young men, and the rugby talent pool was also dwindling. So they shut down the rugby club. It was called the Calcutta Football Club, but it was a rugby club. And they withdrew all the money from the bank account that they had, and they got a whole pile of silver rupees, which they gave to a silversmith. He melted them down and created that trophy. Beautiful trophy with the three handles are cobras, and there's an Indian elephant on the lid. It's beautiful. Oldest trophy in rugby. And it's only played for when England play Scotland, because of the history of that match between the British soldiers in Kolkata. Yeah. And the England have won the most. Nothing else matters to Scottish rugby supporters. They don't care about the World Cup. We're going to beat England and win the Kolkata Cup. That's all that matters. Yeah. So when the fixtures are published each year for this year's Six Nations, the Scots just go to the date. When do we play England? That's all that matters. It's beautiful.
And when did he first play and how many times has he played in that game?
So he made his debut on the third or the 8th of March, 2020, right before COVID, against France at Murrayfield, came off the bench. Scotland beat France. In fact, they clapped France that day. The next week, was like now. It was the last match of the Six Nations in 2020. They fly to Cardiff. They're on the bus to the Principality Stadium for what's called the Captain's Run. The Captain's Run is always on the Friday, the day before. It's not really a practice. It's like half an hour. And the captain, there's no coaches, just takes the team. They walk through a few moves and go back. They're on the bus going there when Gregor Townsend stands up and says, "Sorry, guys, we're turning the bus around. The game's been called off. We're going into lockdown." And so it won it denied him a second cap. Two, he gets an injury coming out of COVID as he starts to train. He literally nearly rips the hamstring off the bone. And that took well over a year to rehab. So he misses all those fixtures, gets back in. On his comeback, his first start, scores 4 tries against Tonga, becomes only the second Scot after Gavin Hastings to score 4 tries in a test match, and the only one to do it at Murrayfield. And just, you know, continued to, and then captain Glasgow Warriors to a URC title. I mean, how can you not be proud of a kid like that, you know? Okay, enough. Yeah.
Mel, I'm so glad you're here, and I don't want to get too emotional for you, but Rory, Mel's our friend as well, and lives in Hermanus. We visited at our home. She was with us on Christmas this year. And I had the privilege of meeting Bob, Mel's late husband and your business partner. Here we have a commandant in die korps who protected Madiba and has built a global business. How did that all happen? And what can you pass on to budding entrepreneurs?
So I would also like to acknowledge Mr. Mark Lamberti here because he's one of our clients. Yeah. So welcome, Mark. And I only met Mark on Tuesday.
Oh, never.
Yeah, because he...
He's a legend.
Yeah.
I've got to tell you a story. Sorry,
yeah, please do. Go ahead.
So, Mark, you might remember back in the day, I sat between you and Gwede Mantashe at an event that we hosted at Gibbs. And it was one of the most fascinating events ever because Gwede Mantashe was talking communism. And Mark Lamberti was talking capitalism, and whoa, the two of these guys, I thought they were going to get to blows, but he's a legend, and it's really a privilege to have you here with us, Mark. Thank you for coming. Thank you.
By the way, if it had come to blows, I would have backed Mark. No, so we now have a young CEO. Bob and I started the business 26 years ago. I left Madiba on the day after he left office. So I worked from day one, the 10th of May, to day Z, the 16th of June, 1990. He handed over to President Mbeki, and I went and resigned from the COPS on the 17th of June. That's why, trivia, when did South Africa muck up that run out between Zulu, Lance Klusener, and Alan Donald in that semi-final that we tied against Australia? 17th of June, 99, because I was standing at OR Tambo and I was sorted. I was on the bus. Hansie had me on the bus. I was going to Lord's. I was going to watch us win the World Cup. Well, I said to my wife, "We're going home. We're going home." She said, "What, man? We've already checked in. What do you mean we're going home?" I said, "Well, it's a waste of time now." But the point is that Ali Bacha had sent me to London to go and observe how England ran a World Cup because the ICC had whispered in his ear that we would get the 2003 one. And he'd already appointed me as head of security for the what was then the United Cricket Board of South Africa, now Cricket South Africa. So I had my first job the day that I started Nichols, Steyn and Associates. That's what it was called. Now, we've just hired a young CEO, a guy called Gareth Katsu, who Mark's son is good friends with, and he has provided certain services to Mark and his family for many years. And when he joined us, he brought that contract into our business. So I'm very proud to say that Mr. Lamberti is a client of NSA. But your question was, how did Bob and I meet? Bob was also the other way around from Kyle, born in the UK and came to South Africa as, I think, a 16-year-old male when his parents immigrated. And Bob was he was an exceptional marksman. And because he was British and they couldn't shoot there, he came out there and found, we've got shooting ranges. And he started a business that had a shooting range. He loved to shoot and they did training. And so the ANC started to talk to Bob around about that period, somewhere between 90 and 94, because their personnel, the ANC cadres, were trained all over the world. Some in Russia, some in China, some in Cuba, some in Angola, some behind the shack in Tembisa. And they needed to standardize that training to run an election campaign. And so they would never have trusted a white South African, but they could trust a white Brit. And they went to Bob, and it was Terry Lakota who initiated the conversation with Bob. And as the ANC do, they were faffing about and dilly-dallying, and the conversation was going nowhere. And then Chris Hani got assassinated. It was a Sunday. That night, the phone rang. Bob's phone. And it was Terry Lakota. He said, Bob, I'm sending the first 200 tomorrow morning. And so Bob trained those oaks. So when I now inherited this new president, who had a home and an office in my town, Bob was still overseeing those guys that he had helped standardize the training of, in a consultancy capacity. So the police contracted Bob and a German guy. There were two independent consultants who consulted on this integration process of the non-statutory forces into the cops. It was very funny because one of the things they did, nobody agreed on anything. Talk about the GNU. Try amalgamating bitter enemies. And I don't just mean bitter enemies in the ideological sense. I mean bitter enemies with weapons. MK cadres trying to infiltrate South Africa and white cops trying to arrest them. That's who we're talking about. And history throws us together and tells us to protect the most famous human being on the planet. That is what history did to us, Alec. And we figured it out. South Africans know how to figure stuff out. That's one of the reasons why I'm optimistic about this GNU. But I digress. So Bob one day phones me around about the time that I've had a conversation with Ali Bacha, and he tells me, when you finish, I've got a job for you. Bob phones me, hey, Rory, let's meet for coffee. I said, yeah, sure. Let's meet at the Kentucky at Epsom Downs. I'm expecting like at least a mug and bean, you know. I said, Bob, the Kentucky. So he's paying, so, you know, whatever. Go to the Kentucky. Bob says, what are you going to do when the old man retires? I said, well, I've consulted a few mentors, and I had, one of whom was Ali, and all of them, I said, look, guys, I know nothing about business, and I still know nothing about business. That's why I come to your conference. I was a civil servant. What do I know about profit and loss? I only know about policing. What do? I love sport. I beg your pardon. And I would love to work in sport. And all of them said to a man, stick with what you know. So as it turned out, Alec, I got the best of both worlds. I still work in sport, but I work in sports security. And Bob and I built a business that, without bragging, I can tell you, we are the world leaders in athlete and team protection. Because we've been doing it, well, I've been doing it for about 35 years because I started in the Rebel Tours as a young cop. But I've been doing it for Cricket South Africa since 99 when Ali sent me to England. And Bob and I had a wonderful journey building this business because Bob was a beaut. I mean, Mel, I miss him every day. Please don't cry because you're going to make me cry. That's my sister there. Bob and I, Alec, as I said in his eulogy at his memorial service, we never fell out. Now, I want you to think about that, folks. Think about any relationship that you're involved in now. Siblings, a marriage, business partners, mates. Can you honestly say that in 25 years you never fell out with someone? I can say that. Bob Nichols and I never fell out, and we're both A-type personalities. So where's the lesson here? The lesson is respect and just give one another space. Bob and I were good mates. Mel is my sister. We watched our kids grow up. We celebrated their milestones. But we weren't brying every weekend, living in one another's pockets. But I loved spending time with Bob because he had such an unbelievable sense of humor. That oak could make me laugh, that I could roll on the ground. Just the random stuff he would say. And it was fun, man, Alec. It was exciting. We knew nothing about business. And then we brought on a shareholder who did know something about business. In fact, a hang of a lot. We got a chartered accountant to join us. Bob and I were 50-50 shareholders. And then we got a chartered accountant. We ultimately sold 10% of the business to, and then the other 23.3. And he was an absolute nightmare as a client. He's Indian from Bombay, not from Durban. He's from Mumbai. And he was ridiculous as a negotiator. And he said, I've been watching your business and I think I can add some value. We said, what do you mean? We said, well, the first thing is you haven't invoiced me for last month. So Bob and I said, okay, maybe we need someone like you. And he's still there. Fortunately, for all the financial boffins here, I was given some exceptionally good advice by my financial advisor. He said, when Jay, our partner from Bombay, joined us, he said, you've got to put a proper buy and sell agreement in place and get the policies behind that agreement. And that's why I can sit here and look at my sister Mel then, knowing that she doesn't have to worry about where her food is coming from, because those policies that Discovery paid out Adrian Gore look after Mel from that buy and sell agreement. So please, there's another lesson there. If you don't have the acumen, go and find someone who does and get those structures in place. We ran that business on consensus. So we took a decision, the three of us, that unless there's agreement, we're not going to move down a certain... And I've got one or two regrets where I was maybe acquiesced into agreeing to a position that I shouldn't have. And Jay and I had a couple of ding-dong battles, but never me and Bob. And I'm proud to say that. I miss him every day. Sometimes I'll just get a random WhatsApp from one of you, and I think, oh, geez, Bob will love this. Can't forward it to Bob. So, Mel, you just keep that memory alive, my girl. We love you. Yeah.
Rory, I want to close off with something a little bit random, and we've come to the end of our time now, but... Gaydon McKenzie today said, and by the way, we won't go into lots of detail, but Rory has done everything in sport, from Cricket World Cups to Olympics to he and Bob and their company, big multinational company, has protected all of that. But today, Gaydon McKenzie said he wants to bring Formula One racing back to South Africa, and he was talking about 2027. What are the chances?
100% it's going to happen. And I can tell you, and this is why I'm not a huge fan of the ANC, because just give me a minute to explain this, Alex. So going on from the 2003 Cricket World Cup, which we very successfully hosted, it went to the West Indies in 07. And the West Indies, well, the ICC actually asked me to consult to the West Indies because we had just had the last one. I mean, it makes sense. Every major event does that. There's this transfer of knowledge and learnings. So I go to the Caribbean and I consult to the security director in the West Indies. Rory, you're getting old, boy. Why am I telling you this?
We are talking about Formula One.
Ah. So I meet this. Thank you. Sorry. It's late. And it's nothing to do with the red wine. I've only had one glass.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So I meet this larger-than-life in every respect American called Don Lockerbie, and he's the venue development director. And he had a wonderful turn of phrase as well, and I'll still quote him. He said, when you're designing a stadium, it's much easier to make alterations with an eraser than with a sledgehammer. Right? So get the blooming design right before you've got to knock down walls. Brilliant. And we stay in touch, and we became mates as fun guy. And in 2023, so 2 years ago, I get a call from Lockerbie. Hey, Rory, confidentially, I'm involved with a private equity firm in Miami, where he lives, who are in discussions with Formula One to bring the South African Grand Prix back to Kyalami. Lewis Hamilton is pushing them hard, and he's pulled together a wonderful design team of architects, of hospitality, people that know major events, construction, all temporary infrastructure, because you can imagine you have to put a ton of temporary infrastructure into Kyalami. That marquee would be a very, very small example of that. But they're the best in the world because they've worked Olympic Games, they've worked Super Bowls, they've worked FIFA World Cups. They know what they're doing. He said, we would like you to join us as the strategic security director. I said, Don, I'd love to. So I get involved. They come out to watch the SA20 cricket that year, and they get hosted at the Wanderers in the long room where we do the security for that event. I talk to them, these private equity dudes. I talk to Formula One. The deal is ready to be signed, and that whole enchilada flies to Monaco to attend the Grand Prix and to sign it into. The only missing part was Gauteng provincial government had to put in $20 million. And late to the party, but they eventually give the guarantee. And they go to Monaco to sign the deal. Now, that was when BRICS was happening in Sandton. And there was this talk of this bunch of numbskulls allowing Putin to attend BRICS and give him indemnity from the International Criminal Court's warrant. And the Americans, not the equity partners, but the Liberty Media, who now own the media rights for Formula One, they bought them from Bernie Ecclestone for 4 point something billion. Conservative Americans get wind of this. They're in Monaco, Alec. They're about to ink the deal. And those Americans said, put down your pens. We are not getting into bed with a government who would give Putin indemnity. There goes the Formula One deal. Gone. Like that.
So what's going to make it come back?
Well, Gayton's going to make it come back. I still want to do that job, but fortunately, and this may be a good thing, because those private equity partners turned out to be a bunch of chumps, even bigger chumps than these oaks who nearly got Springbok Rugby into a gemors. So Gayton will get it back because the plan is there. And it's a good plan, Alec, let me tell you, that these oaks put together. So I've no doubt that it's going to happen.
Rory Steyn, you're a great raconteur, but this has been exceptional tonight. Thank you very much.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you all.
Right now, you can get the cheapest Forex rate around, right here, on Shift. Pay less for your dollars, pounds, and euros here. And get to shop more here. And do more here. And enjoy more ooh-la-la here. Shift also lets you trade and transfer currencies and buy shares in the world's best companies. It all happens right here on Shift. You won't find a cheaper Forex rate anywhere else, no matter where you bank. Download the Shift app today.
In the world of business banking, projections, numbers, and your bottom line can often triumph over relationships. At Investec, we value both. That's why we understand that running a successful business takes endurance, drive, and partners who are willing to walk the journey with you. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. Out of the ordinary.
Downings is South Africa's leading marquee infrastructure company, proudly celebrating 25 years of excellence, renowned for creativity, innovation, and unmatched technical expertise. Our event marquees and semi-permanent structures elevate any project with style and sophistication. Whether it's a corporate event or a commercial project, we tailor every structure to meet your needs with world-class precision. Visit downings.co.za to consult with our expert team. Downings, your trusted marquee specialists nationwide.